Hello, everybody. Welcome to On the Bima, where we chat with Jewish theater makers from around the world about their art, Judaism, and vision for theater's future. I'm your host, Danielle Levski. This podcast is brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater, a nonprofit organization made up of theater artists, theaters, and other people connected to theater to promote the creation, presentation, and preservation of both traditional and non-traditional theatrical endeavors by, for, and about the Jewish experience. Today, we're calling to the Bima the comedian Antonia Lasar, who is based in Los Angeles, California. It's such an honor to have you on our show, Antonia.
Hi, it's such an honor to be here on this show that's about every possible kind of Jewish theater and also probably none of them, according to your description.
It is a very long, all-encompassing description.
It's such a good Jewish attempt to be like, it's about all of it and none of it.
It's a very Jewish description, I agree. And I have to point out, it is wonderful that you're a comic and you're also the first person to comment on that exhaustive description from the get-go on this podcast.
I'm sorry, I feel like I'm being a really bad guest in your lovely home by walking in and immediately criticizing your decor. I'm like,
no, you're so just Julian being a very here. Being a very Jewish guest, like coming in and being like, I have thoughts, I have feedback.
Yeah. I have notes.
I have notes. Well, I'm actually curious to know about some of the notes you might have given to your fellows from the Mendel Fellowship, because you recently received the Mendel Fellowship for Jewish comedy. So what has this meant for your... Yeah, thank you so much. I'm really proud
of that. You're so welcome. That was really professional.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's my job. So what does this mean to you, this fellowship? And I'd love to hear about some of the experiences you've had in the fellowship with other fellows, with the people you've met there.
That I've fellowed with.
That you've fellowed with.
The fellows that I've fellowed with. It's a lot of fellowship is probably the main thing. The fellowship is for Jewish culture makers. I translate it basically as Jewish artists of basically any discipline. And it's a 2-year fellowship where there are 15 of us, and we get together, I think, like 5 times over the next 2 years. And I think they basically pay us to, like, be friends with each other and hopefully we'll make brilliant world-changing art together at some point.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's pretty sweet gig. And it's really exciting for me. I mean, number one, to get such a big, prestigious fellowship. You know, in the art world, you're like only as good as the richest person who's aware of you. And
wow.
And so this brings my bar up significantly.
That is the saddest and funniest thing I've heard in a long time. How do you think this fellowship is going to support your future as a comedian, as an artist?
It's in like some very practical ways, they're organizing mentors for us. I've given them my dream list of comedians. Maybe they'll make it happen. We'll see.
Hold on. We need to know who's on the list. Who's on the list?
So not Jewish, but Mike Birbiglia is right at the top. If he is listening to this world famous podcast, which I'm sure he listens to every week.
Yeah. We definitely have a weekly release.
Yeah, because it's a weekly release also. He reruns it every week. Mm-hmm. He is right up at the top for me right now because he does solo comedy shows that walk this line between vulnerable truthiness and really funny and also a little pathetic. He's the person I want to apprentice with the most. And he has a lot of experience directing solo shows too. I think he directed or at least was involved in the making of Alex Edelman's show Just for Us.
Very cool.
Yeah, I know. Very cool. He's at the top of my list.
Gary Gulman. Love that Jew.
A lot of good Jews on my list. So I don't know, maybe they'll make that happen. So there's a mentorship aspect. There's like connecting with all of these really interesting arts institutions. We had our first retreat already and they connected us with so many amazing art makers. I met with this group Four Freedoms, which is doing political art, and thought they were very interesting. I was like incredibly skeptical of their pitch. I was like, are you really having a political impact? And after talking with them, I'm like impressed with a lot of stuff they do. So they're giving me connections in the world of fancy art people who know how to write grants, which is like not really the world I'm in. And that's amazing. And I'm asking them to connect me with all of their famous HBO and Netflix producers who will produce my groundbreaking Jewish stand-up special on all of the streaming platforms. It's going to be on all of them.
Wow.
So we'll see. I think, you know, they have connections that I don't have. And that's sort of like what you get out of most fellowships is like connections that you don't have. And I'm hoping they're with incredibly wealthy people who think that I am just the greatest Jew in the entire world.
Before this conversation, we were talking about that a little bit, like how you move through the world. Do you identify yourself as a Jewish artist or as a Jewish maker when you're walking through the world? How does that exist for you?
I think my answer to you when you asked me this in our warm-up was, to quote myself. I mean, like, it really depends on the context and who I'm talking to. And to put it extremely bluntly, what I'm hoping to get out of the interaction. If I want to seem like a cool comedian who they should book at the Comedy Store, I'm not a Jewish artist. Jew who? I'm an everyman. I can talk to any audience you throw at me. I'm just a plain old comedian, unless they're a comedy venue that loves to exploit people's cultural identities, in which case then I'm so Jewish, I'm going to give you the deepest cultural experience and it's going to be so meaningful. And then when I'm applying for a grant at a Jewish organization, I'm the greatest Jewish artist that's ever existed. So it's flexible.
Flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really funny. And I think it's particularly funny that as a comedian, like, you pick and choose where you are public about certain parts of your identity.
Yeah. And the internet does a lot of the work for you. I have an incredibly Jewish internet presence. So as soon as anyone Googles me, it's not like they're going to not know I'm Jewish. But still, everyone shapes their identity a little bit depending on where they are. I love the Jewish comedian Modi, and he's constantly saying, know your audience, know your audience. And he should get a new catchphrase, but it is good advice because it's true. Different contexts go better when you bring different parts of yourself. And also there are some people who bring the exact same version of themselves to every context. And that really works for them. And that's a beautiful thing. For me, I like to be flexible.
Well said. Well said.
Yeah. I very Jewish. It's like all of it and none of it.
At the same time. That's our theme for today. All of it and none of it.
Yeah.
Something that does bring up for me is that I noticed that your comedy does frequently explore queer and Jewish identity, often at the same time, and how they interrelate with each other. I'm curious how these identities have evolved for you as you've like portrayed them more publicly with your work.
Oh, yeah. I've like portrayed them both separately and at the same time. So they have narratives apart and together. You know, my Jewishness, I've been, I would say, cashing in on my Jewish identity on stage for a really long time. Like, since I was in high school and I was doing competitive speech and debate, I figured out that I could exploit my inherent Jewiness to win. And that started from a really just sort of obviously exploitative place. And then I got to a place where I was like, I think I'm really only using Jewish stereotypes. And then I did more studying and got deeper with how I perform my Jewish identity. So that's the Jewish part. Then the queer part feels less complicated to me for some reason. It's like, you know, I'm queer, I'm bisexual, I have been for a really long time. It comes up on stage sometimes. It's not often the like core subject of my work. So maybe I just haven't had the opportunity to look at it like with as much of a critical lens. And then together, I know that in putting them out there together, I am turning off a small subset of my audience who don't connect with the idea of queer Jews. Mm-hmm. But most of those people, to be honest, wouldn't be watching me anyway because I'm a woman. So no problem, you know?
Have you ever gotten like explicitly negative responses or just like you think those people don't engage?
Yeah, I've gotten explicitly negative responses. But not enough for me to take them seriously.
Good.
Yeah. And I don't really care about them. That said, in my real in-person life, I care a huge amount about making more space for queer people in Judaism and other religious contexts. And I find myself in very Orthodox and Hasidic spaces a lot and am very experienced in using myself as a gateway queer to for people who don't have queer friends because I'm so approachable. Like I look like a straight woman. I have a husband, easy peasy. I know all of this Jewish lingo, no problem. I can just walk in the door. And then at some point in our like friendship, I can reveal like my actual queer identity and we can get into that. And that's a big part of my outside of comedy life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that also takes a more delicate touch. And I think a touch that's maybe better suited to like building community rather than putting it in a pithy joke on the internet.
True. Although I will say looking at your past like lineup of shows you've done a really good job at approaching sensitive topics with humor, but also with like a lot of delicacy. Like for instance, your solo show, Post-Traumatic, Super Delightful, and God Box. How do you make these kinds of personal stories resonate so universally?
I think like those two shows have the added benefit of being an hour long. Mm. And so that's why I'm able to tackle some trickier topics like sexual violence in Post-Traumatic, Super Delightful, and interfaith conflict in God Box. The hour-long format models a sort of community-building format in that you just have more time to talk about these things. So with those two shows, both of them are like based on my personal experience and my personal story, which is usually that's a much faster way to build trust with your audience. When you can tell your audience, I can talk about this, I've been through it. There are ways to talk about these things without having been through it. You just have a lot more heavy lifting to do to make your audience feel like you are a safe person to talk about these things with. So they come from personal experience. Both of these shows, I'll talk specifically about PTSD, Post-Traumatic Super Delightful, because that's about the most difficult of the two topics, which is sexual violence on college campuses. And that one uses comedy. And I mean, specifically, as weird as it sounds, red nose clowning. Obviously, this is part of your world. Yeah. And mixes it with very serious docudrama. It sounds like a weird combination, and it is a weird combination. But using comedy mixed with being able to reflect someone's actual, real, truthful experience, which I think is what good comedy also does, is a way that I can basically bring down the stakes and bring down the pressure for the audience and make them feel safer. Like you go into a show and you hear it's about sexual violence and you're on edge and it's a scary topic. You're probably like, I'm either going to
identify with the victim or the perpetrator, and both of those suck. You know, it's scary. You're probably going to feel hopeless. They're probably going to try and manipulate your emotions to make you feel really terrible about this in hopes that you do something. And so that's why I really like using comedy in a really warm and non-confrontational way to validate the audience's experiences and what they are literally bringing into the theater, so that then very slowly over the hour, we can get deeper and deeper and deeper. And with from the truth of the comedy, we can get to the truth of like the real life question. And the show was like incredibly successful. Yeah. I toured it to a bunch of colleges, and I would normally couple it with some sort of sexual violence prevention training afterwards. So I'd be a part of like the sexual violence programming. I would come in and do my show, and then they'd come in with like bystander intervention training. And the way that this show was positioned was it took these, you know, imagine all of these like college bros sitting with crossed arms, looking like they'd rather be anywhere else. And it turned them into these like mushy little, like open, curious people by the end of the show who could go into this training with way more openness. So that was how that show worked. And I'm really proud of it. I thought it was really great.
That is so great. I'm so curious, especially about this audience you just mentioned. Do you feel like there was a particular part in the show that really opened them up? Or was it just like a collective of different moments throughout the show that got them to this point of openness?
Much like in real life, I think it's kind of always a buildup of things. And every so often you will hit on the perfect thing that breaks people open instantaneously. But I would say this show really relied on building goodwill with comedy that wasn't harsh or mean-spirited, with centering one of the main characters as someone who's been accused of sexual assault. And he's a really lovely person who everyone likes and is really heartbroken to have been accused of this. And it's a really, like, I think a more accurate portrayal of most perpetrators who don't think they are perpetrators and don't want to be perpetrators. And also there was vulnerability on my part as a storyteller. There's a moment in a show where I get really vulnerable about my personal story. Mm-hmm. And also it is, I wouldn't say hopeful, but it comes in. I like to tie up these big questions by offering the audience options. You know, here are some things in this world that you could do. Here are some ways you could treat people. Here are some avenues for you to start to engage with to make this better, as opposed to just breaking them open and like leaving them in a puddle on the ground.
Yeah.
So I'd say all of those things, plus a really funny ending, all of those together got us there. And it took that whole hour of heavy lifting to open people up.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Have there been any particular student or audience responses that really have like shocked you in a positive way, in a maybe not so positive way? Just something that really stuck with you as a response.
I think like it's been a couple of years. I haven't performed it since before COVID. So it's been a couple of years. But the thing that like always sticks with me is just this like visceral memory of after every single show, just looking at out at this little line of crying people who have lined up to talk to me. And the demographics of that line are very interesting. There's a lot of people who are survivors who feel really seen and grateful that we're having this conversation. And there are also just a lot of crying people. I'm especially interested in like the crying young men who come in really closed off, because they usually don't get a chance to be mushy about this. I mean, young men normally come into the conversation of sexual violence cast as potential perpetrators. So
yeah,
so that is always really, really interesting
to see. And I was also surprised. I was both surprised and it then made sense, the amount of coverage that I got. You know, I was covered by like Marie Claire and Glamour magazine, and all of these colleges were dying to bring this to their campuses because it's, I understand that it's such an urgent topic. It was so urgent when I first made it, which was all the way back in 2015, and it remains really urgent now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's wonderful. And I'm curious because I know you have a new show brewing as well that's exploring Jewish singing, illness, pleasure, and obligation. What were the inspirations for this show, and what are your hopes and dreams for this show?
Yes. I'm so excited about this show. I've done a couple performances of it so far. I've got, I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but I've got a show in Boston on December 9th and New York on December 14th. So go to my website, antonialasar.com, or any of my social media, and you can find information there. This show is stand-up. It's stand-up plus participatory communal singing. I will force everyone in the audience to sing with me. I mean, in part, I wrote this show because I'm so obsessed with singing in groups that I was like, how do I sucker a group of people into singing with me? I have to charm them with an hour of stand-up and then I can make them sing at the end. But it comes from like a lot of places. One is that after I started being more Jewish online, I started getting a lot of DMs from rabbis asking me if I could do stand-up at their synagogue. And I was like, wow, what a great business opportunity. And so I was like, I better write a show. So in part, it comes out of that. But I really was asking myself, you know, like, if I'm going to be doing this show at all of these synagogues, what do I want to say at synagogues? And so for me, it's this like really personal exploration of like, why on earth am I even attracted to Judaism? Because growing up really secular, there is this pervasive notion that people who are engaged in Jewish stuff are only doing Jewy stuff because they're not cool enough to be doing regular secular stuff. And I was always like, why do I want to do all this Jewy stuff? It's so uncool. And I've been asking myself that for years, especially as my like comedy presence has gotten more Jewish. And I'm still working on articulating all of those answers, but there are a couple of big ones. Like one is the culture of group singing is so incredibly powerful and life-changing to me that I'm addicted to it. And it just turns out that Judaism actually tolerates and celebrates group singing in a way that secular culture doesn't normally. The other is that like as a someone who's just chronically ill all the time, I'm kind of obsessed with like pleasure and figuring out what gives me pleasure. And especially growing up in secular Judaism, we are all about only doing the parts of Judaism that feel good. And I later in life started to discover this like very interesting dynamic that happens when you commit to something that doesn't feel good for a long time, that you start to find yet another kind of pleasure that can sometimes be even deeper. Like in my case, it was doing Shabbat. It was like cut, like being really restrictive and saying, no, for these 25 hours, I will not work, which was always something that I resisted doing because I felt like I was just cutting myself off from my friends, from community, from work opportunities. And in allowing myself to just have that really clear restriction, that obligation, it's like, turns out Shabbat is the greatest thing ever. It's like the best part of my life. It has like really revealed something to me. And so I'm just, and this is not to say that all Jewish obligation will lead you to some sort of higher transcendent pleasure, or even that that's necessarily a reasonable thing to look for. But I do think that like these questions of what feels good and what do we have to do are like foundational to Judaism. That's basically the Reform movement and the Orthodox movement. The Orthodox movement is like, you do it because you have to do it. And the Reform movement is like, you don't have to do anything. You do what feels good. And, you know, Orthodox are like, nothing feels good. That's the point.
We suffer and then we die.
Yeah, exactly. You suffer because that feels good. That's simplistic. And I'm sure your Orthodox listeners are furious. And your conservative listeners are like, what about us? But these like pulls between pleasure and obligation are so fascinating. And then the third question is, how on earth do you build Jewish community? You know, like everyone is so lonely, which I know for a fact because I have promised myself to so many communes, so many imaginary communes that I've talked about with so many friends who have been like, when we're older, let's live on a commune together. You've had this conversation, right?
Many, many times, yes.
Yeah. How many communes do you think you've promised yourself to?
At least 63.
At least. It's like we all have this fantasy because we're all so lonely and in unsupportive community. And it feels like Judaism is such a good place to find that commune. And it's not necessarily happening right now. So I have all these questions about why not? What can we do? And also the whole thing is funny and everyone sings. That's the synopsis of the show. As you can tell, I'm really working on trying to figure out how to explain this show.
But hey.
But that's what's going on. And the show is going to synagogues, Jewish community centers. And my long-term vision is to bring more Orthodox or Hasidic and secular communities together at the show because they're singing for very Orthodox people that restricts audiences to women. So I'm navigating that question, but that's like the future of the show. And then it will be put on Netflix by all of these incredibly rich, powerful executives that I'm going to meet any day now.
Right. To tie it all together back to the beginning.
Exactly.
I mean, I think a podcast is a perfect place to explore what you want your art to be about. So I hope this conversation helps you frame some of those things as you bring this show to all those different places and Netflix.
And Netflix.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Antonia.
Yeah. Thanks for having me here. Wait, is that your way of ending this conversation?
Almost. I got to do my little sign-off thing. Is that cool?
Okay, great. Yeah, that's so cool. This was really great, Danielle. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. And also, can I just give a shout out to AJT? I actually don't know if you even know this. Did you know that I came to a conference in like 2013?
I don't know this.
I think it was 2013. And I can't remember if I did 15 minutes or the entire show of God Box. And it was before God Box was really like successful. Like the show went on to have a lot of runs in a lot of great theaters. But before any of that happened, AJT was, I think, one of the first people who like actually took me seriously. And I went to the conference and I thought it was really interesting. And ever since going to that conference, I've asked myself like, what the frick is Jewish theater? Which I felt people were really asking there. And they were like, we don't know. It's like, it's about Jews. It's by Jews. It's doesn't have to be by Jews. It's by Jews, but maybe doesn't cover anything Jewish. We're not totally sure. And that has actually been like an interesting artistic question that I've thought about a lot in the last like 10 years since going to that conference in 2013.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing that. I I think that is one of the main questions that we try to answer through this podcast too. Who is making Jewish theater and what is Jewish theater?
Yeah.
So thanks for being part of that conversation.
My pledge. Thanks for having me.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to On the Bima. A special thanks to Danny Debner, our technical producer, Ilya Levinson and Alex Kaufman, the composers of our theme music, and the entire Alliance for Jewish Theater community. This podcast was brought to you by the Alliance for Jewish Theater. If you like what you've heard today, support this podcast and all of our initiatives towards connecting Jewish theater makers by making a tax-deductible donation to Alliance for Jewish Theater at alljewishtheater.org or joining as a member. Make sure to give us a review on iTunes and learn more about us at alljewishtheater.org. I'm your host, Danielle Levski, and I'll chat with you next time. L'chaim.